It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Soze!
No, that's Matthew Soze.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yeah.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Soze.
Film lovers, and welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. We also have a blog. If you go to WFYI.org, filmsociology/blog. See, Kobe knows this stuff, and he's not here, so I'm going to do my best. Yes, I am hosting and engineering. Not my first choice, not my fifth choice, but what are you going to do? Sitting in with me on this Christmas Eve Eve from the Film Yap and fellow IFJA, Chris Lloyd.
Hello.
Thank you for coming in.
The pleasure is all mine on this Christmas Eve Eve.
Where the office people took today off, and they're taking tomorrow off. But somebody has to be on the air. Might as well be me.
Yep.
I don't mind that.
It's that time of year when those of us who are still at work can't really do much because everyone we need to talk to and interact with is gone.
Right. So that's okay. It's been a busy day here, actually, here at WFYI Studios. We had at 1 o'clock today, we had our premiere of WFYI's A Christmas Carol, which we don't know when we're rebroadcasting it, if it's going to be available online. So I'm already getting questions online about that. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out, especially you employees that want copies. Those who are listening, it's none of your business. And tomorrow night, I will be on the air with the Blues House Party Holiday Extravaganza from 9 to midnight. Yes, I will bring you right up to midnight. I will say final words, and then Santa Claus will come down your chimney and other Charles Brown tunes. And I'll be on next week from 8 to midnight doing a 2011 year in review of the Blues House Party. And next week's show, Kobe will be back. And we'll do probably a highlight. Yes, it's been months since I played the Tommy Wiseau interview, so I'll probably do that. Kobe's been creating some highlight reel, which will feature, I'm sure, your voice and among others in our group of critic friends. And what else? Oh, if you go to WFYI.org, you can also hear the chat that Ed Johnsonat and I did with John Krull on No Limits. That was fun. An hour is not enough. This show is, you know, always, once it gets revving after an hour, so... Anyway, we'll move on. But there's a number of films that have opened today, so if you're caught up on your shopping, or you need a break from shopping, or you need a break from family, it's not even Christmas Eve yet, and you might be tired. But there's a number of films that have opened this week, and we're going to start with is the biggest film to open this week, and it's David Fincher's take on The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah, now when we say opening this week, it's an unusual week in that everything is not arriving on Friday. Things are kind of staggered and spread all over. Some things open on Wednesday. I think a couple more things open today. I think War Horse and The Artist don't actually open until Sunday the 25th, if I'm correct.
Oh, wait a second. Well, according to this non-nouveau thing, The Artist opens today.
Okay, maybe it's today, and it's War Horse on Sunday.
It's possible, but it's become like the stores. You remember, it used to be, you know, Black Friday, we're gonna go open at midnight on Friday. No, we're gonna open midnight on Thursday. No, we're just gonna stay 24 hours all week. So
yeah, Mission Impossible was the most wishy-washy one. It technically went wide Wednesday, but there were actually were earlier screenings like Tuesday, I think, not even midnight showings, I think like Tuesday night, like 9 o'clock screenings. And actually, it was out on IMAX only screens since the previous Friday. So, boy, that one's just all over the place.
And we'll talk about that film in a little bit, but we're going to play for you a little audio of David Fincher's version of the Swedish film based on the trilogy, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So, no, it's not Swedish. Although I love playing foreign film trailers on this show.
It's set in Sweden.
It is set in Sweden. I do give it credit for that. There's
And everyone talks in a vaguely Swedish lilt except for Daniel Craig, who for unexplained reasons is the only British guy in Sweden.
And the most handsome disgraced journalist ever. Ever. By far. You don't see Stephen Glass coming out of the beach like in Casino Royale. So, all right, here's some audio. This is not the 8-minute trailer that they gave us from when we saw Moneyball, but anyway, check this out.
She's one of the best investigators I have.
But?
She's different.
In what way?
In every way.
Something wrong with the report?
Anything you chose not to disclose.
He's clean, in my opinion. He's honest.
Her credibility isn't dead yet.
Mine is.
He's had a long-standing sexual relationship with his co-editor of the magazine. Sometimes he pleasures her. Not often enough, in my opinion.
No, you're right not to include that. I need your help. You come stay on the island. A way of avoiding all those people you might want to avoid right now. You will be investigating thieves, misers, bullies, the most detestable collection of people that you will ever meet. My family. This is Harriet. Someone in the family murdered Harriet. And for the past 40 years has been trying to drive me insane. Those are from her, and the rest from her killer.
You failed to adapt to 4 foster homes. Arrested twice for intoxication, twice for assault. How many partners have you had in the last month? And how many of those were men?
I should have control of my money.
And you will, once you learn to be sociable. Why don't we start with me? You know what to do.
I can't find something you've been unable to find in 40 years.
You don't know that. You have a very keen investigative mind.
You were here that day.
A terrible day. Searching. Not finding.
I've never found the body.
Was it spontaneous?
Was it calculated?
Did she know something? Someone wished she didn't.
The last time I reported on something without being absolutely sure, I lost my life savings. I need a research assistant.
I know an excellent one. She did the background check on you.
The what?
You don't think we could hire just anyone for something like this?
It's Mikael Blomqvist. May I come in?
We need to talk.
Hey, who do you think you are?
Put some clothes on. Get rid of your girlfriend.
Can I call you Elizabeth?
I want you to help me catch a killer of women. I've got absolutely no idea how they're connected to the death of a 16-year-old girl.
Don't you need to look over these?
I got it.
It's better to look at what I am about to show you on an empty stomach.
What are you doing?
Reading your notes.
They're encrypted.
Please.
Rape, torture, fire, animals, religion. Am I missing anything?
The names. I may have something.
Nobody likes people poking around in their lives.
Everybody knows why you're here.
Someone killed her. Someone on the island that day.
If a woman approaches any beast and dies with it, you shall kill the woman and the beast.
These people are insane.
Soon you will know us all, only too well, with my apologies.
Okay, so we have handsome, disgraced journalist Daniel Craig, who has the unlikely team partner in a goth computer hacker, and they're gonna solve a 40-year-old serial killer case, and meanwhile there's, you know, like an onion it's going to smell. No, it's going to, layers and layers are going to open up. And
by the way, that was a really energetic sounding trailer for a movie that consists about 60% of people sitting in front of computer screens or staring at photographs.
No one will be admitted during the crucial downloading scene.
Yeah. Alt click control.
It also helps that you have, and I guess we have to say, Academy Award winner Trent Reznor doing the score.
And it is a very good score.
It is. And Ed made a point, Ed Johnson-Ott made a point of talking about the, I think he called the film Creepy Cool, which Creepy is cool. A quote you would see in the ad campaign. But a Nine Inch Nails cover of Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song starts the film. Yeah. So you get a jolt. Now, as I'm watching this, and when I heard that they were going to remake this, of course, my old film critic pulled up his black socks and said to, Hollywood, get the hell off my lawn. Because, we just saw this 2 years ago and loved the first one, liked the second one, third one. But when I saw that the screenplay is done by Steve Zaillian, who, of course, earlier this year gave us Moneyball, co-wrote Moneyball, among others, and it's directed by David Fincher, who's one of the best directors working today. Well, much to my pleasure, it's not a shot-by-shot remake if you've seen the original Swedish film. It's not Gus Van Sant doing Psycho. But as I was watching this, enough time has passed, and I didn't watch the Swedish one before watching this, how much was, what was taken out, what was left in, what makes this film different by the others. First off, as you mentioned, it is set in Sweden, and we have Scandinavian-esque accents from non-Scandinavian actors, Daniel Craig, Christopher Plummer, Robin Wright. Everyone's favorite Stellan Skarsgård, everyone's favorite Euro Heavy, which was, by the way, if you know the film, little bit of I think they kind of did a little stunt casting that, well, anyway, monologuing is happening.
Yes.
So that was kind of not a shocker. But and also Rooney Mara, a smart move by casting another unknown as the young lady, as the girl in the title. And, she helps dominate the picture. Daniel Craig is very low-key in this, very good.
Compared to his other roles, although if you compare it to the same character in the other movie, I think they made a very conscious attempt to man him up, make him a little more proactive. I mean, like in the Swedish version, he's doing the same, trying to work on the mystery, and the girl in the Lisbeth Salander character basically is shadowing him without him even knowing it, using her hacker skills.
Correct.
And she basically just starts helping him. Literally, she's like a voice that pops up on his computer. And this movie, he, without giving it away, seeks her out, which was that is one of, I think, maybe just two major differences in the movies in terms of the overall plot. Mm-hmm. I've thought a lot about that. I mean, that was a very intentional thing, and I hate to say it, I think the only reason it really exists is to make the male character seem more proactive and heroic, more a standard male protagonist. Whereas, I mean, in the Swedish version, that character is pretty much passive the entire time, definitely is the more submissive, and she is the more dominant personality. And that's, I think that dynamic is still here in the American movie, but I think they made a conscious and I think wrong choice to, let's pump him up just a little.
Yeah, because it's Daniel Craig.
Yeah, because he's Daniel Craig.
And by the way, this is, I think, his best non-bomb performance. I'm always fascinated with the actors who play James Bond and what they do when they're on a break from playing 007, and usually the choices are very, not the case in this one. But the other thing was, I thought, as I'm watching this, I'm like, did they remake just because people in middle America don't want to read subtitles?
And that's where I'm cynical about this movie. I gave it a positive review because I admire the skill and craft with which it was made. There's no denying that I think the people who made this movie, did so without cynicism. But unfortunately, just the endeavor itself is ultimately cynical because the first movie exists. It's only 2 years old. And it is quite good, and as I said in my review, there's nothing that this movie does that the other movie didn't already do and do at least as well, if not better.
And I think, it seemed like it was almost because they could, because they had the ability. And one thing that we talked about yesterday, and also the fact that you have a remake of the film that, much to Fincher's credit, I believe, doesn't pull back. And there's a couple of moments. And those who know the series and the novels, you know what two scenes we're talking about. It involves a bedroom and the title character,
yeah,
and a very smarmy other character.
I will give him that. He did not take the edge off.
No, not at all. And that was really uncomfortable to watch. And Ed made a point of saying that he thought this the Fincher version, that moment is not exploitative or tantalizing compared to the Swedish version.
Yeah.
But that requires having to think about those scenes again. And, well, I don't really want to try to do that for research. But, yeah, the fact that they didn't Americanize the film, they kept the story, kept it Swedish, I guess, for as much as they could. And when it came to really uncomfortable and at times violent spots, they didn't hold back.
No, they didn't.
So I guess I'm with you where I enjoyed the film, didn't think it was necessary, but it was well made nonetheless.
It was still made. For people who have not seen the Swedish version, I would say that they will probably end up being much more enthralled by it than I am. But you know,
yeah, of course.
I can't go back in time and unsee the first movie.
No,
which
and don't want to.
Yeah. So seeing this version, just, you know, if you've seen the first one, there's really not much point. But unfortunately, Not a lot of people go to see the Swedish movies, so.
And do we know is Fincher gonna make the other two? Or is Paramount gonna make the other two?
I would tend to guess if it's successful, because of course this is part of a trilogy.
Right.
If it's successful, you'll probably see the second and third movies come out. My take on it is, I respect the people who made this movie and the reasons that they had for doing it, but I would love to see this director, this screenwriter, and these two stars original movie on their own, because I think they could do something more worthy of their time and mine.
That's a good one. That's a good one. So, but overall, I'll just say,
now that was a good movie.
Just be aware. And by the way, the original girl with the dragon tattoo, she's in the new Sherlock Holmes film. So.
Yes, Noomi Rapace. Am I pronouncing that right?
I believe so. Well, we're Middle America. We can mispronounce things, or we say it two different ways, and it's all right. All right, so we got some other films opening. We're going to make a note of, for instance, The Adventures of Tintin, where there's not one but two Steven Spielberg films opening this weekend. This is the – it's not live. It's not animated. It's in between.
Motion capture.
As Ed calls it, dead-eye animation.
So if it's motion capture, it has to have Andy Serkis.
And bravo for Andy. Andy's had a good year.
He's had a really good year between this and Rise of the Planet of the Apes. You know, I look at it as an animated film. I mean, the whole motion capture thing, I mean, people, I think, are too obsessed with it. And I think the filmmakers, certain filmmakers, you know, who shall not be named Zemeckis, you know, have become...
Have a drink of water.
Caught up in the process, you know, doing the motion capture for the sake of doing the motion capture.
You think it's like their version of 3D?
Yeah, you know, and it's like Mars Need Moms was done with motion capture and didn't need to be.
Not really.
And that's the thing. I think too many of these are trying to sort of, you know, shoehorn a process in there when they should just be worried about making an animated movie with a great story. I really like Tintin. I thought it was the second best animated movie of the year in a pretty weak year for animated movies. I love the look. I think the look here that Spielberg captured is what Zemeckis has been trying to do.
Okay.
With, I think, his three movies that he's directed with motion capture and didn't quite get there. It's, for me, it you know, it's enough. It's photorealistic enough that you know, you should get that sense of danger and that sense of reality. But there's just enough exaggeration and cartooniness to it, to, as they say, you know, keeps it out of the uncanny valley.
Okay. Is it the second best Spielberg film this year?
It is.
Okay. So, we'll get to that. Let's get to War Horse.
My quick line.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My quick line on Tintin that I have to say is it's Raiders of the Lost Ark meets the Da Vinci Code meets the Hardy Boys.
The book or the TV? The TV version where the guys have feathered hair. Tintin have really great coiffed hair.
Tintin did have a... he has this, like, strange-looking, like, flip thing. So it kind of gives him just, like, this little bit of a reddish mohawk.
Oh, I thought it was a blonde hero. I was waiting for you to join the cavalcade.
He's more ginger.
Oh, so he's socially awkward.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
Tintin is actually the most human-looking character. Like, Captain Haddock and all the others all have, you know, like noses that W.C. Fields would go like, that's absurd. So he actually looks pretty much, you know, normal human. Is that little bit of flip hair is the one thing that kind of gives him his cartooniness.
Okay. Well, cool. Now, also opening this weekend, check your local theaters, I guess, but the other Spielberg film, War Horse, which the story won a bunch of Tony Awards, but this one is not a film with actors in horse outfits or marionettes. We have an actual horse, and hopefully not harmed in the making of this film. But what was your take on War Horse?
Terrific. It's an overtly and unabashedly sentimental movie.
From Spielberg?
From Spielberg. Okay. It is a male weepy, which is not to say that females will not...
But it's okay for guys to cry at this one?
It is definitely. I mean, you've got a lot of, like, manly, you know, fathers and sons in conflict and boys with their beloved animals.
Does the horse go out for a catch?
He does not go out for a catch, but maybe, you know, he comes home for a catch.
Okay.
It's a sort of thing where, movie where you know where the movie is going to go and you know where the movie is going to end and... knowing it does not detract from the journey whatsoever. Really terrific, manipulative, and that's a compliment, musical score from John Williams.
No, from
very
John Williams?
Very sweeping strings. Wonderful, wonderful movie. Our friend and colleague who we often reference, Ed Johnson-Ott, said it's the sort of movie that you just have to submit to. Mm-hmm. And if you submit to it, you will be the better for doing so. If you resist it and it's your choice to do so, you'll probably end up finding it a bit maudlin and a bit of a cinematic mash note. I gave in very quickly, and I'm glad I did. It made my top 10 list. I think it was actually number 10, but it made
okay.
my top 10 list.
Well, speaking of top 10s, also opening today, the IFJA called this the best film of the year. Right as of right now, it's my pick for best film of the year. Yes, I'm the host, and I'm dropping this. I'm bearing the lead on this one. But The Artist is opening, and we talked last night, yesterday on the show. For those who don't know, it's a French silent film in black and white. Don't change the dial. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
This isn't commercial radio. You're still here. But this is the type of thing I wish I could go on commercial radio or television and try to explain. But it's a silent movie star whose career starts to go downhill when talkies are made. And he, of course, meets a young girl whose career goes up when talkies are made. And so there's end of an era. There's A Star is Born. But the filmmakers who gave us the French spoof OSS 117, I believe, is or 177, gives us a silent movie. They make, I think, a really bold choice. There's a few really kind of cute moments involving sound.
Right.
But they went full out and made an emotionally charged silent film, and I'm really, really glad they did.
Yeah, I mean, it is a conceit, and I think it's a very self-conscious conceit, of they're making a story about the silent film era transitioning into sound, and the conceit is that their own movie is silent. It starts out with you're in the movie of one of the actual characters. Valentine, is it Valentine or Valentine is the name of the character?
Right, not Valentino, because then the estate will get mad.
And so, and then we do that very common thing we see in the movies about movies, is that, you know, we cut and we pull back to see that we're actually on a soundstage and we're thinking, but it continues
right.
in silence with title cards coming up for the dialogue. Obviously, we should mention, this film is obviously not absolutely silent. There is music throughout accompanying
it. Right, right.
And as you mentioned, a couple of points where the conceit, the veil drops for just a moment, if you will.
And, you know, for music history or film history lesson is, for a lot of actors from the silent era, their careers were ruined because they had no purpose being behind a microphone.
They had faces for silent movies and not for sound movies.
And right, and having
not voices, yeah,
or having a great face for radio like yours truly, but it follows that, and you've seen these stories before. It's a behind the scenes drama. It's a Hollywood drama, but
it's set. We should say it's a French production film, but it's set in Hollywood,
right.
And it's very much a movie of and about Hollywood.
Yeah, and so it's the backstage drama we've seen before, and I think there's no cliche unturned, but it's so sincere, and you follow with him and with her, and they're so good. You said it's set in Hollywood, so expect little cameos by John Goodman, Penelope Ann Miller, not enough Malcolm McDowell. That's the only flaw when an actor you love has like two scenes, and you're like,
and it's 45 seconds,
and he should really be in more. I don't care if he is on the DVD box; he's not in there enough. But if that's my biggest gripe with the film, then so be it.
Right. And also the character who plays the butler, I can never
remember. Oh, James Cromwell.
James Cromwell's in it.
Academy Award nominee, James Cromwell.
Who is, if I read this right, 6'7" in real life.
He's Stretch Cunningham from All in the Cup. Yeah. So, yeah. And Cromwell's one of those guys. It's a sense of relief because he's going to be good no matter how good or bad the film is.
Yeah.
And he plays the driver. And that's another, you know, star staff relationship. Not the help. That's a different thing. But
yeah. And this film is very much, again, it is an homage to earlier Hollywood films. I think very largely Singing in the Rain. It's not a musical, but it has musical elements in it.
And same era.
And the main character looks like, you know, the love child of Gene Kelly and Douglas Fairbanks, either senior or junior, depending on the lighting.
Yeah. There's a snarky comment there, but I'm not going to, out of respect to all three of those gentlemen. But yeah. Not Errol Flynn. That's too.
I love this movie. It was my choice for number one film of the year. It is the only film that I gave my top rating to. You know, depending on what venue you're reading me in, 4 stars, or 5 stars, or 5 Ooh. Yaps, or A. It's all, you know, A, B, C, D. It's the only movie I gave an A to all year.
Wow. Which so is... you hear that, Richard Probst? You hearing that? Yeah, sorry, inside critics joke.
It is, this is the sort of movie that I almost do feel like we as critics have to champion, because I know, I mean, like with Girl and the Dragon Tattoo, certain people just aren't going to go to a subtitled movie. People hear it's French, it's black and white, and it's silent, so there are, in essence, subtitles, and they're dialogue cards.
Right.
And they're just going to stay away.
Don't do that. Don't
this
do
is
that.
This is not a snooty art film. It is an exuberantly, emotionally, embellished tale. It is, you know, self-aware but not self-conscious, not self-indulgent. It is the most emotionally swept away I felt at any movie this year.
Yeah, and hopefully this is also a stepping stone for younger folks, yes, you darn kids out there, to try out silent movies. Try out Chaplin. I mean, and Hugo does that as well, or as I call it, the most gentle, sincere Film Institute infomercial of the year.
Yes.
But that's another one of, you know, if you recognize the images, hopefully you do if you're a movie fan, of Safety Last hanging off, of Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock.
Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton and Charles Chaplin and F.W. Murnau.
And the rocket going into the eye of the moon. So
and
all even, of those.
And Georges Méliès, who got his own shout out cinematically earlier this year.
There you go. So hopefully this will bring. So go find the Criterion Collection of Chaplin, or go find the Keen.
There actually is some stuff on Netflix and Netflix streaming and Vudu and some of those other sites. So go check it out.
So go do that Vudu that you do so well. All right, so
that Vudu that turns Netflix bankrupt, at least as far as the Vudu folks hope.
Yeah, and those things. Let's see. Also opening today, The Darkest Hour,
which they did not. We have a Romney-esque bet going on between myself and Ed Johnson Ott.
Wow, there's a comeback, but I'm not gonna.
I challenge everyone to a $10,000 bet that they were not screening The Darkest Hour for critics, whether it was gonna be for critics everywhere or just here in Indianapolis. So we'll find out about that.
Okay, $10,000, huh?
Well, you know, like with the real life thing. The bet was not actually taken.
It's IFJA dollars.
Yes.
$10. That's $10,000 in our world. And also opening, We Bought a Zoo.
Which they also did not screen for us.
Directed by Cameron Crowe.
Which is depressing considering Cameron Crowe directed film.
Well, apparently he's mad at critics after Elizabethtown. Just like Kevin Smith is mad at critics for everything.
I was going to say, well, we're still mad at Cameron Crowe for Elizabethtown, so we're even. But
and I want to
see
the...
Don't go the Tyler Perry route and, you know, just...
Not do it?
Yeah, and just pretend right. critics don't exist, because guess what? If there aren't critics out there saying, we liked your movie, we hated your movie, whatever, people just don't know about your movie. I mean, go around to general populace and talk about films that have gotten terrible reviews, people at least heard of it, but... Ask people, hey, have you heard about this movie called We Bought a Zoo that's out? I guarantee you probably less than 5% of the population has even heard of it.
And we'll find out on Monday when the receipts come in. And I think we're going to take a short break in a minute. I'm going to run to the Indianapolis Zoo and see if somebody like Scarlett Johansson is working there. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
any good? Sir?
What?
Are either one of these any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs.
You know who I can do without? I can do without the people in the video store.
Which ones?
All of them.
What would you get for a 6-year-old boy who chronically wets his bed?
So, do you have any new movies in?
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
They never rent quality flicks. They always pick the most intellectually devoid movie on the racks.
Ooh, Navy SEALs!
It's like in order to join, they have to have an IQ less than their shoe size.
Just go open the video store.
Yeah, open the video store!
Oh, that's not the Wesley Willis version. I'm sorry. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. Chris Lloyd of the Film Yap is hanging out with me. Glad to have him here on Christmas Eve Eve. Before we get into the DVDs, there was one film. There were some films that opened last week that we get a chance to talk about, and you got to see. I'm sorry, it's not called Mission Impossible 4, because that would sound like a sequel.
Yeah, well, it's MI3 sounded cool. MI4,
not so much. So now it's called, what the heck is it called?
Mission:Impossible.
Wait,
dash,
it does not say colon.
Ghost Protocol. Well, the colon and the dash are in the title.
So what is Ghost Protocol?
Ghost Protocol is,
besides Tom Cruise in a hood,
it's a, you know, double extra secret plan they have.
John Vernon organized it?
Where, no, we've got the IMF, which is the super secret agency of the American government,
right?
Of which Ethan Hunt is the top dog in terms of the best agent.
Right.
And when things go awry, their ultimate plan is to flush the entire IMF down the drain and pretend that it never existed. That plan
so
is called
spy
Ghost
anima,
Protocol.
Basically.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
And Spy Anima, not a good title, apparently. Yes.
With Tom Wilkinson plays the head of IMF, who says,
oh,
you done.
He said it exactly like that.
Well,
with
no.
His American accent.
It's actually a very clever scene where he tells him, you're done, we're shut down, what happened? And Ethan Hunt's like, what happens next? He's like, well, if you should choose to knock me and my associate out here and steal this key that I've got here in my hand, which would take you to a secret weapons cache and so on and so forth.
So Tom Wilkinson's in it, Jeremy Renner, Simon Pegg.
Paula Patton has a really nice role.
Okay.
as an agent who kind of wears her heart on her sleeve. Easily the best movie in the Mission Impossible franchise.
Really?
One of those franchises that you thought was kind of done.
Yeah, well, and I think part of it is, well, as I remember, I remember a lot of people complaining that the first one was hard to follow, directed by Brian De Palma. I was able to follow it. I just didn't care a whole lot.
Yeah.
John Woo was in his John Woo in Hollywood phase. Too bad. And I thought the third was the best because part of it is you had J.J. Abrams directing and Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think, made a great villain. But this time around, it's directed by Brad Bird,
yeah,
who gave us The Iron Giant and The Incredibles.
Which, of course, and Ratatouille, which, of course, are animated films. This is his first live-action film.
And is there cartoon-like action scenes in this?
No, there are, but there are, I think, you know, in a sense that being an animated director really helped Brad Bird here because, you know, with animation, you have to plan everything out way in advance. Everything's storyboarded. Everything's, you know, mapped out to the absolute finest detail. And you can see that showing up in his action scenes, which are so many action scenes in movies nowadays are just these muddled, messy things where they all fall back on the crutch of, well, we don't really know what we shot, so we'll just do a lot of hyper-fast cutting and editing so you never really understand exactly what's going on and what's happening.
Thanks, Michael Bay.
And these action scenes are so crisp and detailed, and they actually pull the camera back, and you can see what's going on in the frame around him, and you see the environment that he's in and the dangerous environment setting the context for that action, and you can see that it's really Tom Cruise doing a lot of these stunts. And the action scenes are so good, really, really well done, terrific. I hate to say it, but I think this is the Tom Cruise comeback. I think he's going to be back on top with this movie.
Okay, well, there it is. So it's still out there. Also opening last week, My Week with Marilyn, which is another backstage drama. It's not based on a true story, or it sort of is, or it's not, and it's kind of...
Based on a guy who claims he spent a week with
Marilyn Monroe, and I could write that story, except I wasn't born in 1957, but it's during the making of The Prince and the Showgirl, and Michelle Williams stars as Marilyn Monroe. We have Kenneth Branagh, and a nice, really nice tongue-in-cheek nod to Laurence Olivier. Judi Dench shows up, Emma Watson shows up, and this is a film where it's similar to The Artist, in which it is a backstage story, kind of a male fantasy story, I think, for anybody that wants to be a 23-year-old into the movie business. But the film is anchored by, I think, a really good performance by Michelle Williams as Marilyn Monroe, who is an icon, who's been everybody from, I think, Misty Rowe to Ashley Judd to Mira Sorvino have tried to play Marilyn Monroe or Norma Jean. And I think this one's probably the most down-to-earth. And you also get to see not just the title of what this young man and what Marilyn does, but also the insecurities that she had, having her acting coach with her, clashing on the set with Olivier and everybody else around her, her marriage to Arthur Miller. I mean, it goes into – it probably is a lot of Marilyn Monroe 101, but it's really well made. But I think this is a film where the performance stands out over the film itself.
Excellent. Have not seen it. Is in a pile of screeners I have sitting next to my computer.
We'll
unfortunately,
get to them.
This got down to the thing where we were doing the awards for the Indiana Film Journalists Association, and I just was running out of time, and I had to turn to somebody and say, "Do I need to watch this one? Is it going to be a serious contender?" And people were sort of very much in the vein of what you just said. People were very respectful, very much like Michelle Williams' performance, but didn't feel like it was in that, you know, that best actress trajectory.
And she might be. I should also acknowledge she was also in a film that I think made my honor high up on the honorable mention list, Meek's Cutoff.
Yeah.
A Thinking Man's West. It's a Western, but it's not a Western.
Yeah.
It's set in the Old West, but there's no gunplay or Ennio Morricone music, and that's okay for this one. So she makes fascinating choices. I mean, between this and Brokeback Mountain and Blue Valentine, and of course she showed up briefly in Shutter Island, but she's always something to look out for. And if you don't know her work, go check it out.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to go to what's new on DVD and Blu-ray. One of the things I talked about with 2011 is earlier this year, it was, I think Variety had an article that this year, 2011, had the most sequels and remakes ever put out in film history. And what I noticed going through the list, not just for No Limits, but for the end of the year, but a lot of the films that made my list or made an acknowledgement on the good side of the list were a lot of films that were steeped in one way or form, shape or form in nostalgia. Films like, and I say this because probably the big title coming out on DVD this week is Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen film. But a film like Hugo, The Artist, I would even say Drive, which was a kind of a throwback to a genre film of a combination of film noir done in the early 80s. Even a title as ridiculous as Hobo with a Shotgun is a throwback to the grindhouse films of the late 70s, early 80s. So there's a lot of these in on my list, and probably was to help balance out all the sequels and remakes. But the fact is, probably the one that's campaigning the most is Midnight in Paris, which many people are saying is Woody Allen's best film in a long, long time. I think it's his best film since Match Point, when he started going overseas to film movies. But it's Owen Wilson, not playing Woody Allen, as a writer who is in Paris with his very impatient fiance, played by Rachel McAdams, and he gets into a car and goes to Paris in the 1920s, and he gets to rub elbows with F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway and Salvador Dali and a lot of folk artists from that bohemian era in the 1920s. It is a light film. It is a I guess for English term, it is a trifle, but it's a really, really tasty trifle.
Yeah, the thing I've heard about this one, the most common refrain from our colleagues, is people say it's Woody Allen's most purely entertaining film in many, many years. I mean, people say best film, better, whatever.
Right.
But I mean, you know, he has gone for more serious stuff in the last 20 years or so. And people say it was nice to see him sort of just step back and just say, let me make a fun, breezy, entertaining movie.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, And this is his, I think, his Valentine, not just the Paris, but those eras. If you followed Alan's work, the stuff that he reads and listens to and likes to watch, well, it's not drifting after 1960. And especially with all the artists that we already mentioned, he loves this era, and it shows. And I mean, this and Hugo, I think, would be a fun double feature if you rent one and then go out and see the other. But yeah, it's really sweet. And the thing that was really impressive with is I think it's Alan's biggest moneymaker to date. I think it's like $60 million, which says something because he keeps his budgets low. Actors like to work with him. But this thing was in theaters all summer. It opened at a particular art house theater on the north side, and then I think it expanded to about maybe five or six other screens around town here in Indy, and it was here. I mean, it was here through the entire summer, and I think that's pretty impressive because, you know, Green Lantern didn't last that long.
Well, Green Lantern did not deserve to last that long.
It did because, yeah, this is... Yeah.
Number one on my list of top 10 worst films.
Well, my next one will be better.
How was that?
Turn it off.
Green Lantern was. I did make a top 10 worst list as well. And Green Lantern did have the dubious honor of being number one.
That was number one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
it's one of those movies that the more you think about it, it actually kind of makes you angry.
You know what? Ed got irritated when I brought up Sucker Punch.
I did not hate Sucker Punch. I gave it a negative review, but there were things about it that I liked.
The girls in the uniforms, because that's really all I had going for me.
It had those different sequences. The first sequence when they're in the trenches with the strange soldiers, they were, you know, revived with clockworks and steam. It had this whole, you know, steampunk feel to it that I just kind of liked.
Okay. Well, you're entitled to that.
Yeah. And it had Scott Glenn, and I love Scott Glenn. He's one of my favorite character actors of all time, and no movie it was ever hurt by having Scott Glenn in it.
All right, I'm going to check that list. I like that. That reminds me of Roger Ebert's rule, which I actually got to correct him on once, where he said, any film with M. Emmett Walsh or Harry Dean Stanton can't be all bad. And I remember saying to him in 1995, there was the thriller Never Talk to Strangers with Antonio Banderas and Rebecca De Mornay. Yes, it is. It's that bad. Anyway, Midnight in Paris is out. I'm going to throw titles, and maybe you saw them, maybe you didn't, but we'll just bring them up anyway. Warrior.
Did not see it. Heard good things from some of my
from the director
critics.
Of Miracle. Some folks are pushing Nick Nolte for a supporting actor nod as the alcoholic dad. Brothers who wind up fighting each other in MMA.
Yeah, and I apologize. I'm not an MMA convert.
That's okay.
Just don't seems like be. A couple of guys beating on each other.
Just happen to be in a ring with beer and admission.
Yeah, people say, it's no more violent than boxing, which is to say that it's just horribly, horribly violent.
And maybe not nearly as corrupt as boxing, at least not yet. All right, also in theaters, and I can tell you she's not here, but it gets the kids' film stamp of approval, Dolphin Tale.
Didn't see.
Directed by Charles Martin Smith.
Did very well for a little short, but a small budget indie. Made quite a box office haul, so kudos to all involved.
And I think that was also a truly moving picture, but yes. It's a dolphin with a tail issue that winds up...
loses his tail, gets a prosthetic tail.
And kid gives it love, so it's Flicka, it's Seabiscuit. No, it's not Seabiscuit. it's...
Free Willy.
Yes, it's Free Willy, only smaller, and there's Morgan Freeman and Ashley Judd. And, of course, we wish all... aquatic scientists look like Harry Connick Jr.
Yeah, well, I think that was conflicting on the night of a screening of another movie, and
it
I can't
happens.
Remember what the other movie was.
Well,
but
anyway,
to...
but it's still out there, and folks can go rent that. Columbiana, the Luc Besson babe assassin movie, because for those who forgot about La Femme Nikita.
Yeah, didn't see it.
That's all right. Glee, the concert movie.
Yeah, not a Glee care. I watched about 5 minutes of the show the first season, and I was like, is this the entire show? And people were like, yeah. I was like,
much.
No thanks.
Lea Michele, call me. For those who want this on Blu-ray, you never know, the Underworld trilogy.
Yeah, because the first one wasn't enough.
Well, you get, let's see. If...
Although, give them props for Before Twilight being, you know, the first thing to do vampires and werewolves together.
That is true. And Kate Beckinsale in skin-tight outfits. And, well, at least with a couple of them, Michael Sheen and Bill Nighy chewing up scenery like nobody's business.
Yeah.
I think I barely recommended The Last Underworld because of them. When they're not on screen, who cares? Go get popcorn for 20 minutes. A film that I know we had in the running for screenplay, Margin Call.
Yep.
So that is out finally.
That was on my best of list. I can't remember if it actually made top 10 or if it was in the, you know, next best of the rest. But
it's based on a true story. And when Kevin Spacey is the least slimy of all of the corporate thieves.
Yeah, by a first-time rookie director, J.C. Chandor, who I think we're going to see great things from in the future. One of those, I mean, shot on a shoestring, but, you know, fantastic cast with Paul Bettany and Jeremy Irons.
Demi Moore shows up.
And she's actually really good in it. Very. I've been calling it the best movie of 2011 that nobody saw.
Okay. So now you have a chance to see it because it's in your stores or on your account online.
Yeah. The thing I really like about that movie is they introduced the Kevin Spacey character at the beginning, and he's just this absolutely despicable, detestable character.
Which we've seen before.
Which, as the movie opens, they literally lay off like 70 or 80% of the people in the company, and then the character who's the boss of the floor, of the trading company, gathers everybody up and says, makes them applaud themselves for not losing their jobs, says, everyone that just lost their job, they were good at their jobs, but you're better, and we will never speak or think about those people ever again. So you just hate his guts. Total villain, and yet somehow, by the end of the story, he becomes the voice of reason and sanity.
Yikes. So if you're not already irritated enough about the economy, rent that.
Yep.
So a film that, it really bugged me. It bugged me, but it didn't bug me enough. But it's the Rob Lurie remake of Straw Dogs, remake of the Sam Peckinpah film. Kevin Martin is not Dustin Hoffman, and Kate Bosworth, as much as I like looking at her, she's not Susan George. But it's I flinch up when I think of somebody trying to remake Sam Peckinpah. The Getaway was
Sam Peckinpah.
That's just a bad idea.
Yeah, Rod Lurie, I did not see this. The remake is one of those ones.
I did because it just ate at me so much to see how he was going to handle. For those who don't know, in this one, he's not a mathematician living in England.
He's a screenwriter
living in the South.
Yeah.
Wow.
Rod Lurie is this one of these directors, you know, with The Contender, that he just can't seem to keep his politics out of his movies.
Disdain for the South.
Right, or basically disdain for anything, you know, right-wing or Republican or the South or et cetera, which, you know, you're entitled to have those opinions, but, you know, to sort of take that whole story and make it sort of a red state, blue state kind of parable, that just doesn't seem like it should fly.
So he's a writer, she's an actress, and they move back to her small southern town where, guess what, all the guys are creepy except for the sheriff.
Right.
And
they're creepy, but they're God-fearing. They're creepy.
That's right. Creepy, God-fearing southern.
They fear a creepy god.
Yes. Well, that I'm not going to answer. Well, or Tebow.
Their god is creepy because they're creepy, evil guys, and therefore they're obviously twisting their religion around.
And so, yeah, they're buying a new house to take over and to refurnish, and the guys aren't helping, and her ex-boyfriend shows up, and then it becomes a trapped in the house story. Now, I'm a fan, and I say the Sam Peckinpah Straw Dogs is not a date film, not at all, by any stretch of the imagination. And it's controversial, one, because of the brutality of the film, of film's violence for 1971 standards. It's not Straw Dogs, but
pretty strong rape scene.
And not to mention the rape scene, where there is a scene where the wife in the original, played by Susan George, is with her ex-boyfriend, and he dominates, and Peckinpah gives the impression that she likes it. And things really get out of hand after that, and, you know, a lot of females in this, and still today, wrinkle their nose at Mr. Peckinpah. Mr. Peckinpah, like Tommy Wiseau, had women issues.
Yeah, oh yeah. I don't think it's so much that he was a misogynist. I think he was very much a Y chromosome guy.
Yeah,
I
say
his meme was all about men and manliness and the things that men do and why men work the way are, and the women were sort of just side stage characters to him.
Yeah, I think in order to be a misogynist, I think you have to acknowledge females. And
yeah,
that's
a good way of putting it. I don't think he disliked females. I don't think he really cared about females other than being extension of male
something
desires.
Right.
And,
so anyway, the remake does go down that path. I thought it was going to be a much softer or more exploitative exploitation type picture. What loses for me is the last 30 minutes. And I think what's – now, I saw this in the daytime. I didn't see it with a full theater, and that's really okay. But it had the feeling that you were going to cheer. You know those Friday, Saturday night rowdy theater audiences that are going to cheer when something bloody or brutal happens. And this seemed like a beer-drinking Hellraising action movie that really, with the original, you wanted to take a shower after watching it.
Yeah, sort of the American Gothic version of I Spit on Your Grave.
The original Straw Dogs, which I always lump with the first Death Wish, and even a more recent example like
Revenge Fantasies.
Yeah, well, A History of Violence as well, of ordinary men winding up doing extraordinary violent feats, whether they knew they had it in them or not. And I think the fact, you know, the Charles Bronson in Death Wish and Dustin Hoffman in Straw Dogs. Yeah, you're right. I think it's the kind of like Bernard Goetz in the subway just waiting for somebody, anybody,
and that is,
to
that
cross
is
them.
Totally at the core of Peckinpah, of, you know, the brutality, the animalistic nature that resides just below the veneer of society.
Well, you know, that was a big deal in 1971. It's every other film now. So yeah, it was really, on one hand, I'm like, well, you had a fairly decent first two thirds, and then the last third just go off the rails. So
sorry to hear.
Go watch the original. Go find the original. I know Criterion put out a really rock solid, as they always do, DVD portion of this. I don't know if it's in print anymore, and I know MGM put out a standard one. So that's out there. Also on DVD and Blu-ray, and I missed this, but it's intriguing, but it's called Blackthorn. And this is the one with Sam Shepard as an aging Butch Cassidy, Stephen Reyes from the Pinkerton Agency.
See, I've heard about this film, but I mean, I don't think it ever got out of, you know.
I thought it was here. I thought it was here for like a week.
Was it?
May have been. But he's Butch Cassidy who survived.
Right.
Sorry, fans of Redford and Newman. But he's, you know, survived and living as an old man on his own, and somebody from his past comes back to haunt him, which occasionally happens in Westerns.
I heard that William Goldman threw his nachos at the screen.
When he wasn't throwing him at Ben and Matt. And finally, an old title for you that's on DVD if you don't have it already. I think it's also on Blu-ray. The 1932 version of A Farewell to Arms with Gary Cooper. Young Gary Cooper.
Gary Cooper was one of those actors that I think wasn't so great when he was young and got better and better the older he got.
Agreed. Gosh, my buddy Paul Haskin over at Mud Creek Players said the same thing about Victor Mature. Not a great actor early on, but by the time the 50s came rolled around, had some stuff.
He was one of those actors that so many of his early roles in the 30s, you know, they kind of were that same, you know, the country bumpkin character.
Male stiff.
Who's very stiff, doesn't know the ways of the city, but his inner goodness comes through, and that kind of got really old after a while. But,
and then along came High Noon.
Yeah, and then so many actors of that era, I think, you know, Jimmy Stewart, you know, they really got interesting in the 1950s when they were in their 50s, late 40s, early 50s.
I'm thinking of Westerns like Randolph Scott, John Wayne.
Yeah, a lot of guys I think were not so interesting in the 30s when they were in their 30s, kind of had like this heyday in the 50s.
And even then, I mean, we talk about how, you know, black hats and white hats and Westerns, and they were like that in the 30s. The 50s, it really changed, obviously, in the 60s with Sergio Leone and the Italian Westerns. But there was a little bit of gray area in the 1950s. If you think, like, John Wayne and the Searchers, you know, everyone's favorite racist hero, among other things. You know, he was the good guy, but he was really flawed.
Very flawed.
So, yeah, there's fun.
And maybe people would often say that he was actually the villain of the piece.
That would be Red River. The bad ending. No, well, not bad ending. Could have been a better ending. All right. We got enough time for, yes, we do movie obits, and it'll bring up old titles maybe you haven't thought of in a while, but that's why I bring it up. But producer Bert Schneider died on December 12th, who's known for such things as a producer. He was an executive producer of The Monkees, the television show. He was also an executive producer in The Monkees film Head, which I don't think is on DVD.
Yeah.
I think probably because of the music, but that needs to come out. That's Jack Nicholson, and it was not A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
It's if you took mushrooms and watched A Hard Day's Night. But he was also an executive producer on Easy Rider, which helped boom independent filmmaking in the late 60s. Five Easy Pieces, so 2 for 2 with Nicholson. Drive, he said. Well, but he was also an executive producer on The Last Picture Show, which has featured a guest on the show, Peter Bogdanovich. And sorry. And then one of Lou Harry's favorites, he was a producer on Days of Heaven, Terrence Malick's second film back in 1978. So, Bert Schneider, thank you for producing those. I own, see, Days of Heaven, Last Picture Show, Five Easy Pieces, and Easy Ride. Yeah, I own all those.
Wow.
Need to have Head on DVD.
Who else died?
No, that's about it. Well, no, well, it's not roll call. Last week, well, and last week I talked about, no, 2 weeks ago, Bill McKenney,
yeah,
who was not the apple of Ned Beatty's eye in Deliverance, the squeal like a pig guy.
Yeah.
Even though the guy's had a pretty long career, unfortunately, he's going to be known as a squeal like a pig guy.
Yep.
So.
He had a nice career. He played
Outlaw Josie Wales, and you look
character at, actor, you know.
Right. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, but he had a very distinctive look. And he kind of had a little bit of a revival the last few years. I seem to recall reading an article about him. Didn't he have some kind of a second career in another arts form?
I think so.
Like a painter or something like
that? There's a lot of actors that do painting like that.
Well, they got a lot of time on their hands.
That's true.
A lot of downtime between takes.
Need that Billy Dee Williams artwork. Would love that in here. But no, he's one of those, if you see him, and now, of course, that we have IMDb, you go online, oh, you look at the stuff he's done before, like, oh, wow, he did all that. Oh, yeah, that's right. He was in this and he was in that. And, you know, you'll hopefully check those out. I was reminded of that. I was watching The Debt, and I'm a fan of Kieran Hines, the fine actor over there in the UK. And the first thing he was known for, really, was there was a film version of Persuasion done in the 90s in the Jane Austen boom. It was a Jane Austen film nobody saw. Everybody saw Emma and Sense and Sensibility, but there was also Persuasion. And then I remember seeing him he had brief roles in The Sum of All Fears, and also in Road to Perdition. And he's got a great face and a great look. And then you go on like, oh, wow, he's done all of these things.
Yeah,
so,
sort of a Scott Glenn type of guy.
There you go. Aha, very good. So, yeah.
By the way, Road to Perdition, one of those movies that not too many people saw that I love.
I love, and I saw that in theaters.
With Daniel Craig.
He is in that. See, it all comes back to what we talked about earlier. That's what film critics do, ladies and gentlemen. Find ways of tying loose ends.
And drop name references.
Jude Law was in that as well, and he's in Hugo.
Wonderful. Jude Law was
wonderful
in that.
Weird thing.
Probably has, you know, a total of a paragraph of dialogue in that whole movie.
But really effective.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Sam Mendes' follow-up to American Beauty. That was shot in – part of it was shot in northern Indiana, I think, like around the Gary area.
What did he make between that and Revolutionary – didn't he do Revolutionary Road?
Yeah, he did that. He did Jarhead.
Okay, yeah, that's right. He did Jarhead.
He did Jarhead, which is – I guess I need to watch that again.
Yeah.
I don't remember getting bowled over by it watching it.
Yeah,
and,
that's one of those movies that just didn't make an impression.
And I loved Away We Go. His lightest film with John Krasinski and Maya Rudolph as the couple trying to find a.
Oh, that was him?
That was him.
I didn't realize
that.
He's
not all just doom and gloom. And
Joe Shearer, my partner at the Film Yap, loves that movie.
I told you to watch that when you knew you were going to have a kid. I think every young couple or old couple having a kid should watch that.
Yes, just so you can ask that immortal questions that all parents need to ask. Are we F-ups?
That's pretty much what the film is about. All right, here are some words to live by, whether you have kids or not.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Chris Lloyd of the Film Yap. Go, plug the website. What do you got going on over there?
Lots of reviews. All these movies that we've been talking about opening this week, we've got reviews of all of them up. Videos, interviews. My top 10 list was just posted, so go check that out.
Ooh, wow. I'm waiting until the first Friday in January before I do that.
And, of course, if you're still trying to get that last-minute Christmas present, you can go to Amazon.com and get my book, Reeling Backward. Still available.
I have mine, folks. Go get yours. Chris, thank you so much for hanging out. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Liberal December greetings to everybody. You can, I'm that guy. You can listen to the Blues House Party's Holiday Extravaganza tomorrow at 9 o'clock on WFYI 90.1 and HD1. I'm Matthew Soucy saying go see a good movie. You deserve it. Next week, end of the year, extravaganza. Kobe will be back. He's got some highlight reel. God help us all. And I think there's movies opening next week. I'll let you know about them. And if not, we'll probably play the Tommy Wiseau interview anyway. It's been months. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.